From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Jo Carroll Pierce, one of Austin, Texas's best loved songwriters. Her songs about fast-driving, irresistible boys, redemption, and desire have been recorded on a new tribute album by her famous and lesser-known musician friends. Also today, re-examining the 1950s. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Halberstam wrote his new book, The 50s, to investigate how the decade shaped the nation and his own life. He was a young reporter covering the civil rights movement in the South during the second half of the 50s. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Menace to Society. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton is meeting at this hour with Lonnie Guinier, his nominee to be the top civil rights enforcer at the Justice Department. The meeting comes after a day of intense lobbying by Guinier supporters, including leaders of civil rights and women's groups. They were reacting to rumors that the White House is preparing to withdraw the nomination in the face of criticism that Guinier is too radical on issues such as minority voting rights. The White House canceled its regular afternoon news briefing today, and Guinier called off some scheduled interviews. Guinier's supporters say she deserves a chance to defend her views in a Senate confirmation hearing. South Africa's disenfranchised black majority may finally cast their first ballots next April. Political negotiators set April 27th of next year as the tentative date for democratic elections after 350 years of white minority rule. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Johannesburg.
The April date could still be changed, but even as a tentative deadline, it has enormous historic and symbolic importance for blacks, who make up nearly 80% of the population. Deprived of basic civil rights under apartheid, blacks will finally be able to choose their own political leaders. The African National Congress, the main black opposition group, lobbied hard for the April date. ANC leaders warned that blacks were growing impatient with the year-and-a-half-old negotiating process. Though it may be another 11 months before elections, negotiators hope that by proposing a concrete date, they have restored some faith in the slow-moving political talks. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
The bodies of two women and three children killed in the arson attack in Solingen, Germany, have been brought to Turkey. They'll be buried tomorrow in their hometown in Anatolia. Deirdre Berger reports from Cologne.
The Turkish president and prime minister will attend a memorial service for the victims of the firebombing attack in Solingen last Saturday. The German foreign minister, as well as a delegation from the German parliament, will also attend the ceremony in Turkey. Earlier today, President Richard von Weizsäcker spoke at a memorial service in Cologne, Germany, about the long-standing friendship between Turkey and Germany. He remembered that Turkey offered a safe country of exile to thousands of Nazi victims. After the ceremony at a mosque in Cologne, a small group of Turkish demonstrators smashed windows on a nearby street, causing damage estimated at hundreds of thousands of dollars. The German cabinet warned the small groups of Turkish demonstrators who have clashed with police in recent days that foreigners who commit serious crimes will be deported. For National Public Radio, this is Deirdre Berger in Cologne.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 8 points to close at 3,545. The NASDAQ Composite Index was up a fraction of a point at 706.2. This is NPR. Medical experts said today that there have been no new cases reported of a mystery illness that's killed at least 13 people in New Mexico and Arizona. Investigators said that no new cases of the flu-like disease have been reported since Saturday, when a 13-year-old Navajo girl died of it after collapsing at a school graduation ceremony. Most of the victims of the illness have been young, otherwise healthy people, and 8 of them have been Native Americans. Officials warned that the epidemic may just be in a lull before striking again. Investigators have been unable to identify a specific virus or other agent that's responsible for the illness. Police have arrested one suspect in a courthouse shooting in Newark, New Jersey. Steve Inskeep reports.
The suspect's name is Eddie Lee Oliver Filson. His cousin was on trial on drug and weapons charges in Newark. A narcotics officer named John Cesarek was the key witness in that case. But before Cesarek could testify, prosecutor Clifford Miner says, Filson slipped into the courthouse carrying a gun past metal detectors and shot Cesarek dead.
This individual came to the courthouse with the express purpose of assassinating this police officer.
Allegedly, Filson also shot and wounded a sheriff's officer as he tried to escape. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Inskeep in Newark, New Jersey.
Texas Governor Ann Richards has vetoed a bill that called for a non-binding referendum on whether Texans should be allowed to carry concealed handguns. Richards dismissed the measure as a taxpayer-funded opinion poll on behalf of gun interests. About 250 opponents of the measure were present as Richards signed the veto. Hanging nearby were banners listing the names of almost 3,700 Texans who were killed by firearms in 1991. Critics said that Richards was denying Texans the opportunity to voice their opinions on an important issue. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you live outside Texas, chances are you've never heard any songs written by my guest, Jo Carol Pierce. That's why her friends and admirers just recorded her songs on a tribute album called Across the Great Divide. She's very popular in Austin, where she now lives. This year, she won Austin Music Awards for Album of the Year and Songwriter of the Year. Billboard described the new album as an amazing introduction to a unique songsmith. Let me play you one of my favorite tracks. This is the song Ruby. It's sung by Troy Campbell, who also produced the album.
Ruby, 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 I've honored your name. I've often called you my sweetheart. I've even called you my friend. Ruby, I never thought I would be calling you somebody I used to know. Well, the lines are all down in this West Texas town. I guess I'll just leave you alone. Ruby, the moon shines down on our full house. Say goodbye to my dark, shiny jewel. You are
we'll hear more of Jo Carol Pierce's songs a little later. Pierce is just beginning to establish herself nationally as a songwriter at the age of 47. She also works as a social worker answering a hotline. This week she's in Philadelphia performing with several other artists from Texas in a work in progress called Chippy, Diaries of a West Texas Hooker, as part of the American Music Theater Festival. Pierce stopped by our studio, and I asked her how other musicians started doing her songs. She told me it happened after she started performing them a few years ago. Here's how she started performing.
I was writing this musical, which was supposed to be a standard kind of musical, and every time I'd get the material and try to fit it into those type of slots, it would just crack because the material is kind of abstract in lots of ways. So these friends of mine from Dallas said, come up and open for us. And I said, well, whatever would I do? And they said, well, just tell the bad girl story and sing the songs like you do in the living room. So that's what I did. And I hit some of the worst, most horrible, hideous notes. And people just died laughing. And it was a big hit in Dallas. So I started doing the same format, which is an odd kind of stand-up comedy, theater, and songs in Austin. And then it was a big hit with musicians, and these friends, David Halley and J.D. Foster, started working on it with me. And they were real hot in the Austin music scene, and they just started getting me gigs and kind of saying to the Austin music public, listen to this. This is something special. Bless those boys.
The show that you did that used your stories mm-hmm. and your songs was called Bad Girls Upset by the Truth. Were you a bad girl?
Well, yeah. I was a bad girl, but, you know, in the story that I do, it talks about 157 boys. I'm thanking Jesus for the 157 perfect boys that he gave me. And there weren't really 157 boys. I know people see the show and they get up and say, is Jo Carol really like that? But in terms of what I really think a bad girl is just one that doesn't go for the regular deal. Because I was raised up, and it was a very business-like thing, the way romance and everything was presented to me, is that you bargain your virginity for lifetime security. And, you know, a whole generation of us just couldn't fit in that way. And so we did other things. But, I mean, you had to do other things. You had to break the rules to have any kind of a life in Lubbock, Texas, when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s.
Tell me a little bit more about what it was like to be a girl growing up in Lubbock in the 50s and 60s.
Well, it was, I remember, you know, Jimmy Dale and I went together when we were in high school, and I remember when I was about 15, 16, he said, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I said, I want to be a pilot. And he said, there are no women pilots. You can't be a pilot. And it was the first time that had ever dawned on me. And I started looking around, and there weren't any women pilots, but there weren't no opportunities for girls to really do anything in school. I mean, like PE was calisthenics and maybe some dance lessons and stuff like that. It was pretty frightening.
Did you have your adventures through boys, since it was more difficult for girls to do things?
Oh, yeah, I really expressed myself through boys, you know. But then until I was in my early 20s, I really didn't have any girlfriends. I just ran around with this pack of boys, and I loved being the only girl in this pack of boys. I had no idea what I was missing out on, not having any girlfriends, but that's the way it was, and I was kind of the token girl and also the queen girl, you know.
The queen girl?
The queen girl.
What does that mean?
Oh, just that I was the only girl, so, you know, it was just a fun position of authority in that group of boys.
Several of your songs have cars in pretty prominent spots in them. What were cars really important to kind of get out and get away?
Oh, man, you had to have wheels. Yeah, that was the only way you could get out. And then just for entertainment, just driving around, that was, you know, jumping bar ditches in your parents' car. That was it. That was the only entertainment after you'd already seen the movie show that came for that week, you know.
A good place to neck also.
Yeah, right.
There's a song of yours I want to play that has to do with boyfriends and cars, and it's called My Boyfriend. Do you want to say anything about the song before we hear it?
Well, I just love these girls that do this song. They're called Pork, and I was real amazed that they chose this song, because to me it was just a real lyrical, sweet, romantic song, and then when I heard their cut on it, I just died laughing, and I just bust out laughing every time I hear them do it. I just love it.
And this is from the tribute album to Joe Carol Pierce. It's several singers doing her songs. The album's called Across the Great Divide, and this is My Boyfriend.
He's like a new car. He's like a fine new car. Takes me everywhere with him. Pull the top down so we can ride around. We can ride this wild blue wind through this lonesome town. You know deep down, only nights like this are meant for burning down. Gonna burn it down again. Just burn. He's a wild card in your cup of gin, a house of cards your heart lives in. Joker's knocking on your door again. You can try hard to ignore him, but your cards are folding up in silky tins. He plays her heart before him.
In your one-person show that we were talking about, mm-hmm. You talk a lot about being called crazy, mm-hmm. and your mother mm-hmm. wanting to institutionalize you. I didn't know how much that was a device for the show and how much that came out of your life.
Oh, no, my mama didn't want to institutionalize me, but I always really did think I was crazy, and I think all bad girls had their doubts because it was such a straight and narrow path. And I know whenever we did anything, and we're still like this a little bit, whenever we did anything that was not what we were supposed to do, we always said we were mean. And I look back and I think, we were anything but mean, but that was our idea of, because you had to be mean to break all these many strictures. And so we thought we were mean. And we've always, you know, made it kind of a good deal to be mean and talked about who was the meanest girl from Lubbock, and who, which there was no doubt about who that was, and who was the second meanest and all that.
Who was the meanest girl?
The meanest girl was Barbara Bass, and she was my best friend, and she kind of taught us all how to be bad girls in a lot of ways. She was an extremely subversive person and very much adored, by a real influence on many, many women around Lubbock and Austin, and also one of the main ones who gave us a lot of encouragement for being creative.
You said that in the show, you say that your mother used to take you to mental hospitals to demonstrate what happened to bad girls.
My mama didn't do that, but I know I modeled the mother in Bad Girls after my dear friend's mother, who did do that. And there were some women in her family who had been put in the mental hospital. And it was always thought that her mother was crazy. Her mother is one of the most delightful people I've ever known. She's a constant stand-up comic. But she's undergone a lot of stress, just trying to find a way to express herself in a narrow life form. And she did. She used to pee behind trees in public parks, and she didn't have any kind of philosophy or anything like that, and neither did we. But it was extremely encouraging to me to meet. She was like one of the first real human adult voices that I ever heard, and she had a tremendous influence on me. This was Barbara's mother.
My guest is songwriter Jo Carroll Pierce. Her new tribute album is called Across the Great Divide. Back after this break. This is Fresh Air. Austin-based songwriter Jo Carroll Pierce is my guest. If you expressed yourself through boys when you were a teenager, was it hard to break yourself of that habit when when you grew up? Especially when you grew up and got married.
When did I grow up? Yeah, it was. There were always been lots of darling boys around that caught my interest. And I think I just had a certain amount of running around to do it, quite a lot, you know, 20, 30, 40 years of running around to do to get it at all out of my system. And also I had many fears about getting married, since I didn't grow up with any. And the idea that I grew up with, and I think this was a subtext from my mother and from other mothers of our generation, was, my mama in the play, and she, my mama really did say, said, men are a pack of savages, but you have got to capture one to protect you from all the rest. She really did say that. And I grew up with the idea that marriage was a horrible, hideous way for a woman to live, but you had to get married. So I had a lot of really ambivalent feelings about that sort of life, although I have been married several times.
How many?
Three.
So your first marriage was to Jimmy Dale Gilmore, mm-hmm, who had been your high school sweetheart.
Yeah.
Did you move from Lubbock when you got married?
We ran off right after my daughter was born, and she was about 5 weeks old, and we headed out in an old Rambler and $65 and moved to Los Angeles so that he could be a musician. And then we moved back to Lubbock, you know, several times. People were always trying to escape from Lubbock, and for many years you just kept getting busted back there, and, you know, pretty soon your friends would be busted back there too, and stuff. And then we all kind of eventually settled in Austin.
And I don't know, it seems like Austin has a whole subculture of people who are different, who kind of escaped from smaller towns in
Everybody
Texas,
in Texas migrated who wants to Austin. To live. Yes.
So you like it there?
Yeah, it's a wonderful town.
When you had your daughter, did you encourage her to be different, or did you have this instinct that as a mother you should try to encourage your daughter to be, quote, normal?
Well, I don't. It would have been so silly for a person like me to be spouting normality to her, but I did find that my values for myself were adventure and fun, and my values for my daughter were bodily integrity and survival. They were real different. But I didn't even have to do any of that because she, I think just in self-defense from me and Jimmy both being kind of spacey, kind of chaotic, you know, and not needing a lot of security, Elise grew up to be a person with her feet firmly planted on the ground. So we raised an adult.
One of the songs on your new record is called Reunion,
mm-hmm.
and Jimmy Dale mm-hmm. Gilmore sings it.
Right.
Did you ever think that one day he'd be singing one of your songs back when he was the musician and you probably thought of yourself as having nothing to do with music?
I always loved music so much. Yeah, I actually did think that maybe he would sing one of my songs. But it was still kind of a surprise, too. And I didn't, when we started putting together this tribute album, I didn't ask Jimmy. He was so busy. You know, he's really got a lot of stuff going on and a big electric contract. And we're real successful exes, and we're very fond of each other. And I didn't want to presume on my friendship to him. And then I ran into him in the grocery store one time, and he said, "You have to let me sing Reunion." And he sang it to me right over in the produce section. And, of course, I mean, when I wrote that song, I thought of Jimmy, because nobody can sing that song like Jimmy Dale does. And it's just beautiful what he does with that song. And Jimmy's voice has always inspired me musically. It is like nothing I ever heard, you know.
Well, I want to play that song.
Yeah.
This is Joe Carroll Pierce's song Reunion, and singing is Jimmy Dale Gilmore.
It's today you say you're leaving, darling. Time comes when you must follow your own star. And though my silly mind is sick with fear, in my heart I know that these differences just go to show how much the same we are. Someday we'll build a new home up in the canyon by the falls, splashing water our companion under shooting stars. And when Mother Earth and Father Time reunite us one more time, we'll remember that we've never been apart.
That's a song by Joe Carroll Pierce from the new album Across the Great Divide, which features a lot of singers performing her songs. Since when you were younger, it seems like you really gravitated to men who were musicians. When you started being a songwriter yourself and mm-hmm. could fulfill that part of you through your own work,
mm-hmm.
did it become less important to fall in love with men who were musicians because you were able to make your own music?
It really did. Yeah, my boyfriend now is an artist, but he's a musician too, of course. I don't know. Music was such a big part of the wonderfulness of growing up, a big part of the good stuff. I could never imagine a church that didn't have great music in it. That's one of the things that I've always wanted in church and I never could find. So it would be real hard for me to really get away from music. I would never get away from it. And doing it myself, it doesn't mean I don't still hang out with a lot of musicians. But there's some way where I don't have a romantic need for musicians in my life anymore.
Do you ever get angry and think to yourself that if you were growing up in a place and in a time where women were encouraged to go with their creative talents, that you could have been an established songwriter a long time ago?
I never do really actually think about that. It makes me more mad, you know, in terms of the younger kids coming up that I see, because I have a daughter, and I see that in a lot of ways things haven't changed, and it doesn't make me mad about myself. I think I've had a most amazing, magical life, and I wouldn't really change it. I think that growing up in Lubbock in that little box made some, you know, it forced us, we're sort of like bonsai trees, you know, we're forced into some unusual, and I choose to accept it, kind of growth and perceptions that I wouldn't have had otherwise. I value the experience, but I don't want it to be that way for my daughter and my granddaughter. I do not. And some of the same attitudes I see, they really do make me angry now, but I take responsibility. I mean, I feel like I'm kind of a timid person, and that I just had a lot of growing to do. I really was pretty crazy and pretty miserably unhappy in my 20s, and I had to go through a lot of stuff to get to a place where I had enough energy left for myself to write songs with, really. So I really don't think it could have been any other way. I'm a tumultuous sort of person and had to just get through some of the major storms.
What made you miserable in your 20s?
Oh, God. I had a lot of childhood stuff to work out, I think. And it's real hard for me to be analytical, and so it was always hard to know exactly what it was. But I know, you know, I was real surprised that I was much happier in my 30s, and then I've been really happy in my 40s, amazingly enough.
Jo Carol Pierce, it's really been a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, I really enjoyed it.
Jo Carol Pierce's new tribute album is called Across the Great Divide. It's distributed by Rounder Records. Here's a friend, Terry Allen, singing her song I Blame God. This song is also included in the new theater piece Chippy, which is being performed this week in Philadelphia as part of the American Music Theater Festival.
Hey, I don't blame you for leaving me, especially since I drove you to it. But can you really blame me for my part? I was just born too stupid to know my own heart. To tell the truth, can't the blame really be laid with the Creator? Who made this world without end? It's His original sin, this world in which you and I are living apart. I blame God. He's the only one original enough to make a mess like this, and even He can't clean it up. I blame God. I didn't do this by myself. I had divine assistance. I blame God. I know you were tore up by all those things Jesus Christ told me to do. And I don't blame you for blaming me for all this pain. But the things that I did do tore me up too. I know we were meant to be together eternally. And we would be if it wasn't for Him, His little bitty world without end. His original sin, not mine, His world in which you and I are living apart.
No, we're still living apart.
I blame God. He's the only one original enough to make a mess like this, and even He can't clean it up. And I blame God.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Jerry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, when women were pert and men were reliable tab hunters. We talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Halberstam about the 1950s, the decade which many people think of as uninteresting and uncomplicated. In his new book, The 50s, Halberstam explores how the decade set the stage for the turbulent 60s. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Menace to Society, a new movie set in the Los Angeles inner city about teenagers who don't care if they live or die and can kill without flinching. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton called his controversial nominee to a top Justice Department job to the White House this evening after a day that backers of Lonnie Guinier argued that she deserves the right to appear at nomination hearings to battle charges that she holds extreme views on civil rights. Due to opposition to the nomination from some members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, President Clinton has been under pressure to withdraw her name from consideration from the top civil rights job at the Department of Justice. Health officials in New Mexico are bracing for the possibility of new cases of the mysterious illness that has killed 13 people in and around a Navajo reservation on the border of New Mexico and Arizona. NPR's Joanne Silberner has this report.
There have been no new cases since Saturday, but officials don't know if that means that the epidemic is ending or if it's just a lull before new cases arise, and they're worried that it may just be a lull. Infectious disease expert Gary Simpson of the New Mexico Department of Health says that the 20 cases reported so far occurred roughly in two clusters, separated by about a week. So public health officials are making sure there will be doctors on call this weekend in case the disease strikes again. The puzzling illness starts out like a regular case of the flu, but has killed some of its victims within hours. In the meantime, scientists are continuing their search for a cause and a treatment. And tribal officials are getting the word out that if anyone in the area develops flu-like symptoms, they should seek medical care. This is Joanne Silberner in Santa Fe.
A special session of the foreign ministers of the Organization of American States met today in Washington to talk about the current political turmoil in Guatemala. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
The foreign ministers of the Organization of American States today openly questioned recent steps in Guatemala to return that country to democratic rule. Romeo Escalante, Guatemala's permanent representative to the OAS, tried to convince a special session of foreign ministers that his country had restored constitutional rule. Last week, President Jorge Serrano suspended Congress, the Supreme Court, and constitutional rule, but this week he was apparently forced to resign by Guatemala's army. Vice President Gustavo Espina announced that he would succeed Serrano, but Guatemala's Congress has not yet approved him. Secretary of State Warren Christopher said today that Guatemala must return to genuine democracy. If it did not, he warned, Guatemala would find itself increasingly isolated. Washington has already suspended economic aid to Guatemala, and other OAS members are considering similar actions. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 8 points to close at 3,544.87 on volume of 281 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a margin of nearly 5-4. This is NPR News. In Cologne, Germany, a service for 5 slain Turks turned violent as protesters fought with police. Police are holding a teenager in connection with the firebombing that killed 2 women and 3 girls. Speaking at the service, the president of Germany said that hate crimes are a danger to civilization. The firebombing was the worst attack yet in a series of violent acts following German unification 3 years ago. German Chancellor Kohl did not attend the memorial service and has been criticized and accused of trying to avoid offending right-wing voters. Protesters ran down the street after the service, smashing shop windows. Cologne is 15 miles from where the killings occurred this last weekend. U.S. and North Korean negotiators report little headway in their talks on keeping North Korea in the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Meanwhile, South Korean President Kim Jong-sam warned his country cannot pursue ties with the North until suspicions over nuclear weapons are resolved. NPR's Anne Garrels reports.
After 7 hours of talks in New York, Robert Gallucci, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Political Military Affairs, said, "I cannot report any significant progress," but he said the two sides have agreed to meet again tomorrow. North Korea has announced its intention to withdraw from the Non-Proliferation Treaty rather than permit the International Atomic Energy Agency to inspect two suspected sites, reinforcing suspicions North Korea is developing nuclear arms. U.S. officials have not said what inducements they were prepared to offer the North Koreans to open their sites to international inspectors, though Gallucci has said concessions are possible. Today, as a further inducement to the North, South Korea's president said his country would offer aid to North Korea if it agrees to international inspections. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved up against other major foreign currencies. Gold prices also moved up. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Halberstam started his career in the 50s. In his new book, The 50s, he re-examines the decade and finds it was much more interesting than it appeared on the surface. The decade remembered for conformity actually sowed the seeds for the social and political upheaval of the 60s and 70s. Halberstam is also the author of The Best and the Brightest, The Powers That Be, and The Reckoning. He covered the early war in Vietnam for the New York Times. He spent the second half of the 50s covering the civil rights movement for Southern newspapers. I asked him why he wanted to write about the 50s.
Well, I wanted to write about it for a number of reasons. I had done The Reckoning, which is a book about America at a moment of jeopardy, you know, the Japanese beginning to challenge us industrially and economically. So I wanted to go back to a moment when we had been supreme, a time of real American economic hegemony, which was in the 1950s when everything, when God was in his heaven and the economic order was blessed and everybody's income went up 10% a year and inflation was low and everybody was spending more all the time. Part of that, I think, is also that I'm in some ways a child of the 50s. I graduated from high school in 1951 and from college in 1955. And many of these experiences, particularly the early civil rights days, because I was a reporter in Mississippi and Tennessee, were part of my life. And so, you know, I don't think journalistic autobiography is really very good. I mean, journalists spend 30, 35 years being reporters, and then someone with a book contract comes to them and says, "We'd like you to write a book about your life." And the truth is they don't really remember anything that happened. I mean, they sort of remember filing their dispatches from the PTT in Saigon or Leopoldville or Zaire, you know, or they say, you know, when I got to Paris to represent the New York Times, I felt that I got on quite well with a General de Gaulle. While we were not exactly intimate, he would often say after press conference, "Monsieur Halberstam, your question was beautifully phrased today. Your French is getting better." Well, you know, so this in a way is my way of doing my autobiography, but except in an exterior way. This is the world that I was part of and in some way helped form me.
Did you go back and you refer in the beginning of the book to pictures from the 50s that you were looking at and how formal they seemed, all the men in their suits, everything seemed to be in place, all the teenagers looking rather square.
And prim.
And prim, yeah.
The women are pert and the young men are sort of four square and reliable. They have a would-be Tab Hunter look to them.
Yeah, if they were lucky, they'd be Tab Hunter.
Well, I maybe not so lucky if they were Tab
Hunter, too. So did you go back and look at pictures of yourself also?
Well, I've led such a vagabond life that there are very few pictures of me in the 50s. You know, I've lived in great disorder. Those years were years first in Mississippi and Tennessee, and then immediately I was overseas. So an awful lot of stuff that I should have in my possession, I don't. But there is a very famous photograph taken, not famous to the world, but famous to me and my colleagues, taken in 1954 on the Harvard Crimson. Three or four of us are sitting there, we're the editors, and we're sitting with Adlai Ewing Stevenson of Illinois, who was then the most beloved of liberal Democrats. And we're sitting there, and there I am. My hair is very short and very black, a great deal blacker than it is now. My face is sort of square and kind of a can-do American face, and I'm wearing the requisite tweed jacket and gray flannel slacks. And dear God, my wife really loves this photo because it shows how much she's improved me in recent years. White socks. There it is, the man with the white socks. So there are not a lot of photos existent, but there are a lot of photos in my mind of me in the 50s, of the simpler time and of my own ambition to be a reporter in the civil rights movement and of America in change.
You went to Harvard in
yes.
the 1950s.
I entered 1951.
What did you see for yourself when you looked ahead? Did you see yourself as being, you know, a leader of tomorrow?
No. I came from a sort of middle-class background. We never had any money, but because my father had served in the war in World War. The Depression in World War II had cut us out of money, and we never had money, but we had... we were middle class. There was never any doubt that my brother and I were going to go to college, and we were supposed to therefore trying, in the tradition of the children of Jewish immigrants, to go to the best. And by some mistake, we both got into Harvard from public high schools. And I never saw myself as a leader of men. What I wanted to do very badly, very early on, was to be a journalist. I thought that was what I wanted. I wanted to see if I could do it and do it well. And if I could do that, I wanted to be in on the action. I wanted to be a part of events. My heroes were men like Hodding Carter, who was the great Mississippi journalist who fought the Klan, and John Gunther, the wonderful globe-trotting journalist, and Theodore White, who was already writing wonderful books, and Harrison Salisbury of the New York Times, who was, when I was a sophomore in college, writing from Moscow for the New York Times. And I mean, it's interesting because there was a recent review of one of my books in the Boston Globe, and it referred to me as this generation's Theodore White and John Gunther. And I thought, what a wonderful thing. I have become in the same lineal collection as my heroes. And then there's a new book by Harrison Salisbury, who is vibrant in his 80s, and he lists some of his heroes, and he's done a chapter on me. So it's been very nice. I'm like the kid who wanted to play center field for the New York Yankees when he was a little boy and ended up growing up and doing it.
My guest is David Halberstam. He's written a new book about the 50s called The 50s. We're going to take a break. This is Fresh Air. Journalist David Halberstam is my guest. Now, the 50s was the decade that there was the first teenage generation that knew what it meant to be a teenager. In other words, teenagers had their own lifestyle. Teenagers became their own market. Yeah,
the coming of the youth culture. Yeah,
exactly. Now, were you a part of that? Or?
Oh, God, no. No, I'm really I'm an interesting person in the sense that my mores are set in the 50s. I'm a 50s person, and by that I mean growing up, the dates that are important in my life, 11 years old, 7 years old at the time of Pearl Harbor. I mean, I find stunning that we have a president today that cannot say where he was on the occasion, on the moment of Pearl Harbor. 11 years old at the end of World War II. So, I mean, I knew the Depression, I knew World War II, I had all the cautiousness of that part of the 50s. And then because of my own odd professional choices, being part of the early civil rights movement, I mean, covering the early civil rights movement, and then also covering Vietnam very early on and being one of the earliest pessimists, I have the odd contradiction of having a lot of the things that flowered in the 60s in me, but being a square from the 50s. I'm a square who got caught up in the most primal issues of the 60s. So I have a foot in both camps. I mean, my values in many ways are very old-fashioned and conservative, but my political allegiances are profoundly affected by the shattering duality of those events, civil rights change in Vietnam.
Well, you write about the coming of rock and roll in the book. Did that have any impact on you?
Well, see, sort of less. I think when you're that, I was about 21 when I was in West Point, Mississippi, which is, 50 miles north of Tupelo, and I was at Partlow's drive-in one night, and someone said about this guy singing Hound Dog or, you know, Heartbreak Hotel. Is he one of them there at Tupelo Presley's? I mean, I used to watch Elvis's, Chet Atkins, the great guitar player, used to run the RCA Studios in Nashville, and Chet was a pal. I'd go hear him play in Printer's Alley, and he would let me sneak in, and Elvis, who was exactly my age, it would come in, and I'd be hidden away watching these great secret sessions. But I was never as profoundly affected by rock. I think maybe, you know, I was 21 when it happened, which means my music of choice and which fashioned me is when I was a boy in my parents' home. So it's really much more likely to be Sinatra and music of that generation. But Elvis is a critical figure. He's the first great coming of the youth culture. There is, I think, one of the most, you know, we think that politics is only politics. We think that, you know, you want a political moment in the 50s, you know what, here's one. Adlai Stevenson runs against Dwight Eisenhower for the second time. I don't think that's nearly as important a moment as the moment when Elvis Presley goes on the Ed Sullivan Show. I mean, let's go back to this. Here's Elvis, the first figure of the youth culture. Not only that, he's a first figure who is blending the white and white American music with black American music, a white face on black music. And he's Sam Phillips down in Memphis at Sun Records has always been looking for somebody like this. The night that the DJ there plays his music for the first time, the switchboard lights up. I mean, it's not hyped, it's not promoted, it is just visceral. And when they bring him in for an interview, they go find him in a movie theater. He hasn't got a phone. They have to call the neighbor's phone. They bring him in, and they say, I'm going to interview you, so don't say nothing dirty. So, and at the end of the interview, he says, when are you going to interview me? He said, son, I just did. Anyway, they make very clear that he goes to Hume's High. And the reason is that's because that is a white high school. They want to make clear that this is not a young black man. Well, he has this great success, and it's visceral. It's the youth culture. The kids have money, and they have money to spend on their own money, and they have their own record players. They're not dependent. You know, their moms and dads can't say, turn off that record player. That belongs to us. This is our living room. Then go to their rooms with their own little $45, $25 record players.
So are you telling us that you actually were at recording sessions with Elvis Presley in the 50s?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was the one reporter allowed to be, for example, Colonel Parker, when Elvis came back from the Army, Colonel Parker allowed me to be the one reporter to travel with him on his train ride back from Fort Dix to Memphis. And he's my age. He was a very sweet young man in those days. Anyway, the great moment, this is two really important political moments in the 50s. One is Brown versus Board of Education.
Wait, I have to stop you a second.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. We'll get back to this.
Okay.
So yeah. What did you talk to Elvis about on the train?
Well, you know, I said, you know, how does it feel? I mean, there are these girls squealing at every stop. He says, I don't know. You know, I said, you know, why do you think it happens? He said, Mister, I don't know why it happens, but it's happening. I'll do the best I can with it. He was this very shy, quite modest country boy, not unlike a lot of others. There was this fluke thing that had happened. He didn't quite understand, but he was going to do the best he could with it. He called everybody, sir. He called me, sir. I was his own age. I looked at him and I said, hey, is that a suntan? He said, hell no, that's a wintan from being a tanker in Germany.
How'd you like being called, sir?
Well, it was about the first time. Other than a few years, 20 years later, when you called me, sir, it really hasn't happened very often.
I think that's maybe a Southern thing.
But it was—he was. I found him very sweet, and I thought incredibly unpretentious. I mean, there was no arrogance. Now, there may have been secret arrogance behind the calling of everybody, sir or man. But he seemed to me about the least rebellious young man I'd ever met. Anyway, this is, I think, two critical political moments. One is Brown versus Board of Education, which I think forever changes America racially, culturally, in every moral. I mean, you know, who are the most beloved athletes of today? It's not Joe DiMaggio and Ted Williams. It's people like, you know, Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson. People, I mean, they are the heroes. I mean, this country has changed forever by that decision. The second one is, I think, the moment when Elvis goes and sings on Ed Sullivan's show. Ed Sullivan is, in any real reason, in those days, the true American minister of culture. He decides what's going to go on his show, what's mainstream American and what is not. He's not just only a variety entrepreneur. He's a censor in any real sense. And he says very publicly, I am not going to have this young man, Elvis Presley, on my show because what he does is dirty. And so Elvis goes on Steve Allen's rival show on Sunday night. Steve Allen has never beaten Ed Sullivan before in the ratings. Elvis goes on, and for the first time in history, Steve Allen wins. And with that, Ed Sullivan quickly folds his tent, surrenders, sends Colonel Parker a telegram booking Elvis for three shows at $50,000. Elvis comes on, and that is the end of the old order. The old order, which would like to keep Elvis off, can't because of the commercial power of the new youth demographics. And Ed Sullivan quickly goes on and says, I want to say this about Elvis. This young man is the finest young man. We've never had a better experience with a young man. And of course, they shoot him, by the way, from the waist up. But that is as dramatic a moment in American culture. That's a very important political benchmark.
You were one of the first reporters to challenge the government when you were reporting on Vietnam. Yeah. In the decade before, the 50s, the decade that you write about, you were covering the civil rights movement. And you were seeing probably a lot of authorities who were masking the truth. Were the roots of your skepticism about the official truth, were those roots for you in the 50s?
Yes, I think covering the civil rights movement was a great place to go and start taking skeptical pills. I mean, you'd go into a town and the mayor would say, hey, you know, our colored folks, they're all happy here. They like it. My maid just told my wife today, you know, that those people there with Martin King, that they're all troublemakers, troublemakers from the North, the communists. They would say, and they'd say the NAACP, except they'd always deliberately mispronounce it and say the NACCP. They'd always deliberately, you know, and they'd say that Martin Luther, and then, you know, they'd make some pejorative reference to King. I mean, very early on in the South, since the entire matrix of established authority, mayor, governor, by and large senator, judges, were all so totally lined up against the forces of integration and obeying the law of the land, that very early on, and they obviously were convinced that whatever movement there was to the indigenous civil rights movement in their own states and communities, therefore was not legitimate, and it was only orchestrated by what they thought was outsiders. And there I was with other reporters going around and talking to the local black people and knowing that they very much indeed wanted to have integration. They wanted the better things of American life. They wanted their children to go to better schools. They wanted to make more money. They wanted to enter this society as a full-fledged member, and that these were very strong, powerful, proud people. So that was there was a healthy, you know, amount of skepticism that you picked up then.
David Halberstam, his new book is called The 50s. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing more about the nomination of Lonnie Guinier to be Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. Nina Totenberg reports on the latest and whether President Clinton's going to stand by his nominee or whether the nomination might be pulled. I'll be talking with a supporter and a critic of the nomination about the legal writings of Lonnie Guinier that are so controversial. Also, our report tonight on the language law of Quebec. Now, one provision of it was recently declared a violation of human rights by a commission of the United Nations. That's one that bars English from the signs on businesses. We'll be hearing about the language law and how it got that way.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Alan and Albert Hughes are 21-year-old twins from Detroit who've already made their name directing rap videos for Digital Underground, KRS-One, and others. But the Hughes brothers have become a lot more famous recently with their first feature film. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of Menace to Society.
We've been here before. South Central Los Angeles, with its wood frame houses and brown lawns and drive-by shootings. The scene is familiar from movies like Boys in the Hood and Grand Canyon, but the Hughes brothers instantly put those movies in the shade. Menace to Society is the most polished, intelligent, and powerful movie yet made about ghetto life in L.A., and one of the most remarkable debut films in recent memory. It's a gangster movie, really, about the rise and fall of a smart young criminal named Kane, played by Tyron Turner. Kane isn't a sweetheart being led astray, like the hero of Boys in the Hood, and he isn't a psycho like his friend O-Dog, who opens the movie with a bang by brutally murdering some Korean shopkeepers, not because he wants to rob them, but because they insulted him. Kane is a pure product of his environment. He grew up watching his mother OD and his father shoot people when they insulted him. And even though the Hugheses make it clear that there's a spark of genuine virtue in Kane, they also paint a grimly deterministic picture of a multi-generational death trap. If you grow up in this world, you're bound to replicate its evils. You're bound to live by the gun and die by the gun, to answer a diss with a bullet, and to avenge every wrong, imagined or real. This is a world in which mindless macho and the ready availability of guns cause a kind of chemical reaction, and the Hugheses watch the combustion process with a passionate detachment. They don't preach and they don't pass judgment, but every sequence has its own lyricism and every scene its own originality. For instance, Kane gets arrested because he was there when his pal killed the Korean shopkeepers, and suddenly the Hugheses thrust us into an eerie interrogation scene in which Kane more than meets his match and a detective played by Bill Duke.
Now listen to me, little bitch. I'm gonna ask you some real simple questions and I want some real simple answers. You understand? Let me get this right. You bought the bottle of beer about 11:15.
I bought the beer and I accidentally dropped it.
You bought the bottle of beer at
11:15.
Then why wasn't the bottle cleaned up? Why did we find it still there, spilled on the floor after the shoot?
After I left, other people was coming in when we was leaving.
But you don't remember what they...
How many police interrogation scenes have we seen in the movies? And yet, this one, with its knowing, laconic detective and its stuttering yet cocky criminal, feels absolutely fresh. Menace to Society has the power and the scope of real tragedy. The movie may anger a lot of people because it doesn't offer much in the way of hope or blame. It's not about how it's all the white man's fault. And it's not about how education and black unity will save the day. What it is about is the axiom that for some in our culture, life is cheap. In this movie, you watch how it becomes that way. That kind of honesty may be difficult to face, but in Menace to Society, it's presented with a vigor and bravado that I, for one, found more inspiring than 1,000 message movies.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. We'll talk with directors Alan and Albert Hughes on tomorrow's show. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director is Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the elections in Cambodia. We talk with Stan Susser, who covers Southeast Asia for The New Yorker. Also, we talk with the Hughes brothers, the 21-year-old twins who directed the new acclaimed film Menace to Society. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.